going to say that we are very lucky to have Daniel Schemla this week.
And I'm interested in experimentally studying correlated systems. Yesterday I was interested when Gabby gave his talk that he essentially classified the weakly correlated material as where we understand everything perfectly, and those who are strongly correlated is when we understand nothing. But after I noticed that when he was talking about understanding, it was very simple experiment, like measuring the resistance or the magnetization. And what I'm going to try to show you today is that if you are a little bit more sophisticated from the experimental point of view, for example, rather than using one beam, you use two beams. It's not much. Then you see a lot of new things, even in those weakly correlated systems, that we don't understand, or we understand partially. Of course, and I agree with Gabby, we start with an arsenal of, you know, band theory, random phase approximation, mean field, and so on. So we can do a lot of things. But as soon as we start to measure nonlinear response, then things become much more interesting. And in fact, we can get information that are well beyond the current understanding. First, my coworker, my group at Berkeley, in fact, only Leonid and Shiwei are still here, all are gone. Without the wonderful sample that Art and his group are making for us, nothing that I will say today will be possible. One of the reasons why we look so carefully at semiconductor is because we can get almost perfect samples. And compared to cuprate and manganate and so on, you know that you're measuring intrinsic property and not something related to some defect. So this is very important. Lou Sham spent a year on sabbatical with us. And as you notice, most of the theorists working with me are not in the US.
Who's Sham Lou?
Okay, I'll introduce quickly the difference between the static and dynamically generated correlation in semiconductor and show you that you can measure 2 and 4 and 6 point correlation function and, you know, put in doubt many of the approximations that we are used to consider as valid. I'll show you something about a new experiment that we are just finishing on a quantum structure containing a two-dimensional electron gas that we very, very carefully measure and study in the quantum Hall regime, but again using static techniques. And when you start to use time-resolved technique, it's very interesting. Yesterday night, I timed myself. I wanted to also speak about some new results we obtained with Leonid Butov on degenerate exciton gas, but I won't have the time to do it. Nevertheless, I have some view graph in my computer, so if people are interested, I can give a small, maybe half an hour talk on this separately. Okay, why do we use time not coherent nonlinear spectroscopy to study the correlation? First, correlation has two facets. One, it makes the quasi particles. So those are seen in the linear regime. But then what the theorists call the residual Coulomb interaction, describe the interaction between the quasi particles. So this is what limits their coherence, limits their lifetime, and responsible for the scattering. And therefore, this can only be seen if you look at nonlinearities. If you limit yourself to linearities, you cannot see this. The second point about time resolve, scattering between quasi particles are quantum effects, so they are interference, they are not point-like collision, and I will show something about this. Therefore, the collision takes some time, let's say of the order of the period of the interacting wave, period of a phonon, period of a magnon. And therefore, you can see things during that time if you have the time resolution. So that's why you need to have at the same time nonlinear, coherent and time-resolved techniques. What do we measure in the optics? So for the theorist, you can call this a green function. I'm more down to earth. I prefer to look at the density matrix. The population are the diagonal term, off-diagonal term, describe emission and absorption.
Now, if we were in a perfect system that we know completely, we will not need this term. Everything will be coherent. The Heisenberg equation or Schrödinger equation tell you if you know the state at one time, you know the Hamiltonian, you know for the future. But everybody adds relaxation time, or not relaxation time, relaxation process that describes the interaction of the system with some reservoir. And since we measure the polarization, falling from this, we have also two terms in the polarization, one that is currently driven by the light beam, and one that is due to the interaction of the system with the reservoir. So let's see each one of those parts. Most of the theory that are applied to electron system basically use this diagram and try to correlate different correlation function involving 2, 4, and 6, and so on points. Now, when we do optics, we put a laser beam that is time dependent. And in fact, this is almost like half of this. I put different color to show that one is longitudinal, the other is transverse, but it's essentially also something like this, making a transition between two electron or two hot state. Or so we are forced to look at the Heisenberg equation. And because of this term, when you write Heisenberg equation for two particle correlation or two point correlation function, you find two and four. You use all the tricks you can. You find for four, you have four and six, and so on. So you have a hierarchy of proper equation. And you can put this in any language you want. This is one problem we need to truncate at some point, the expansion of those equations. So this is what I call static correlation, and those are dynamic coherent. And this is the part that is coherent in my previous equation. Now, how relaxation appear? Suppose that we use a laser. Typical value of the laser period is between 2 and 4 femtoseconds. So at the very beginning, there is oscillation of charge between the valence band and conduction band level going up and down. And this coherent regime, depending on the system, lasts between a few femtoseconds to a few picoseconds. Then things start to happen when the carriers are in one of those states, and they can interact with different waves, phonon, plasmon, magnon, rotron, and so on. And therefore, there is relaxation. So if there was no relaxation after a short pulse excitation, the Rabi oscillation should last forever. If the reservoir interacting with the system is infinitely fast, then the response is an exponential in the time domain, and we call this Markov response. And we can describe this by a dephasing time or a decoherence time if it's a single quantum dot, for example. And in most of the case, what we have is some kind of a memory. The system remembers of the past. And therefore, the response is not really an exponential. It's more complicated than that. And this is the second part of the equation that I have. So let's look at modern. I don't know, I lost something here. A modern optical experiment setup look like you start with short pulse laser. Now if you have enough money, you can buy a 5 femtosecond laser. It's $250,000, but you can come and just, you know, push a button and it works. And in general, you need to have some tunability. I'll show you later on why you need to have this. So essentially, you start with one pulse. You split this in, let's say, two beams, and you get an interaction in the sample. And then the signal goes out. Most of the case, if you do coherent optics, it go in the very well-defined direction. So if you put some iris, you can really isolate this from the two laser beam. And then you can make several measurements. So using those mirror, you can change the time delay between the two pulse coming in the sample. So by just changing this time delay, you can integrate the signal. So the integration is over all frequency and all the time delay. And because we are all lazy, this is the first experiment you do because it's not too complicated. Now, if you want to have
the power spectrum, you can fix this time delay and go to a spectrometer, multi-channel analyzer, and measure the spectrum. So for each time delay, you can have the emission spectrum of the sample. If you want to look at the time structure, you can take a third pulse from the laser and mix this with the signal in the very fast nonlinear crystal, a transparent crystal. Then by changing the time delay between those two pulses, you can make the profile of each pulse for each time delay. If you want to know the phase, then you can make a Mach-Zehnder interferometer between the nonlinear signal and the laser that you have well characterized, and then you record those kind of interference fringes, and you have the phase. So if you measure those four signals, first it's a pain in the butt because you have to spend a week or two to do the experiment, but you can measure the complex electric field coming out of the sample. Not only the intensity like many people do, you can have the whole information on the electric field as a function of the time delay. And this is now in many, many, many labs. So let me show you, for example, first an experiment that we did when I was in Martin Wegener lab on my Humboldt. It's a very simple four-way mixing experiment, just two pulse on a piece of gallium arsenide at low temperature. The only thing is that the pulse are very short, like 15 femtoseconds. And you see that rather than an exponential decay, you see oscillation, very marked oscillation. And explanation was given by Armut Hogg and his group. Because the pulse is broad, very short pulse, several levels are excited in the conduction band, and you start to have phonon collision between excitons that are electrons that are coupling those two levels. Okay, and this oscillation is exactly due to the period of the phonons. So that's fine, that's nice. But to show you what you can do now, suppose that you add another pulse. You just duplicate the first pulse, you put two pulses. Using some tricks, you can fix the distance between those two pulses to 10 attoseconds. Attoseconds is 10 to the minus 18 seconds. Light is very nice with other experimentalists. There is many tricks you can do to those kind of things. And then I'm going to show you the same type of curve, but changing this time delay over only one period of the optical field. So there is 2.7 femtoseconds between this curve and this curve. And you see that you have those strong oscillation for certain distance between those two curves, but then you have this beautiful, absolutely linear exponential where the phonon interaction has completely disappeared. So what is going on here? The first pulse come in, and an electron phonon interaction start to occur. Because the phonon period in gallium arsenide is 115 femtoseconds, the collision between the phonon and the electron is long. The second pulse arrive, and if it has the right phase, it can take all the degrees of freedom of the phonon, put them back in the electronic system with the right phase and the right direction, and completely cancel out the collision. The collision does not exist. The electron continues to live by itself. It does not know that there is phonon around it. Okay. So that means that if you start to make coherent control of your experiments, all the Boltzmann kinetics are no more valid. Now, I was expecting somebody to tell me, in an atomic system, when you have an excitation, the excitation is zero on the other side, and the curve I've shown you has a non-zero negative time delay. Okay, and this is the resolution of the experiment, so all those things under the blue panel should be zero. And obviously it is not, and that's a very important result to understand correlation. So this result itself contradicts the few level model that people are using in describing an exciton as a single single resonance. So this is the kind of theory that people like Wilfried Schaeffer or Martin Axe are using. I'm not going to comment too much on this, but every time I try to show comparison between experiment and theory, Those are completely solved. Usually it takes like a night on a cray. This is the energy of the electron, energy of the hole. So for Gabi, we start from the effective mass. This is the interaction between the field, that this is the dipole moment, and the system, and those are interaction between electron and holes, and electron and holes. And depending if you have a magnetic field or not, you can use the different effective mass and the different value for the Coulomb potential and so on. Then the equation of motion for the polarization is just a term of energy multiplied by the derivative of the time. This part is just the Coulomb interaction. So in fact, if you hide this, you will find the Vanier equation for an exciton. This is the coupling of the electromagnetic field with Pauli blocking due to the fact that if you create a carrier, they will reduce the interaction with the field. And then the interaction is, again, electron-holes, hole-hole, and electron-electron. So this is too complicated for an experimentalist like me. So what I did was to assume that all those index, and there was spin index, band index, and so on, I could just collapse them into one index. And I call this model the average polarization model. And it's useful because it allows you to discuss the structure of those equations. So we've seen that single particle level do not work. The first type of approximation you can do is to factorize the four particle correlation function into two. This is random phase approximation.
I have a question as to what would you like to see? You're putting an electric field, so that would be your forcing term. Mm-hmm. And then you play games with different pulses, different durations, etc. And what's the major quantity?
I'm going to show a few of them. Okay, many of them.
Okay.
So, for example, we'll be going back. This, I would like to have a curve showing me this.
Which is basically the.
This is the intensity versus the time delay.
Of an outgoing pulse.
But I'm going to show more sophisticated than this because we measure also the frequency domain and so on. So this is called the semiconductor block equation since the work of Stefan Koch and Armut Hoge. We developed this to a very sophisticated level. So to answer to Gabi, suppose we put two pulses. I put them blue and red just for make it clear. But it could be different color. It could be different color, the same color. And then once you collapse all those equations into a single index, you find something like this, which is very interesting and simple. If I hide this part. This is exactly like atomic physics, an oscillator with some dephasing time driven by the Rabi frequency. And this term is just the Pauli blocking, so as you start to saturate your transition, the transition becomes smaller. If I hide this part, then this is a Gross-Pitayevsky equation, where the polarization interacts with itself through the Coulomb interaction, and therefore you also get the same thing as the Landau-Ginzburg term that you have in high-TC superconductivity. So it showed immediately that a laser excited material is something including atomic physics and correlation, even at the RPA level. Now, why do we have this negative time delay? Suppose that I have a pulse, so this beam has a very short pulse, and associated with him there will be a polarization that will start here and decay like a step function exists. And then another one here was the blue pulse and this polarization. You see that this term is a coupling between the polarization and the field. So if the red field arrives before the polarization is created, there is no signal. This is what you find in atomic physics. Okay. Now, this term is two polarization. So if when I have two step functions, they interact whatever is the order. And because it's a square here, one is going to decay twice faster than the other. So the signal associated with the atomic-like response as zero on this side and the decay on this side, the signal associated with this is on both sides with a slope here, exactly twice the slope on the other side. Okay. So that's the hand-waving explanation of the previous experiment. Now what is important is therefore all the signal that come at negative time delay is due only to Coulomb correlation. So it's a little bit like NMR. If you choose your sequence, you can isolate one type of origin of the signal. That's very important because then you know exactly that what you're looking for is only for certain sequence of time. So if I told you that everything I told you was right, if we take a sample like this with two peaks, the fact that there is two peaks is not that it's bad quality. It's because when you grow something on molecular beam epitaxy, the layer are very thin, so there is some stress, and the symmetry is not exactly the same, so the light hole and the viewer are slightly split. On the contrary, you see the width of those peaks is extremely high quality. So if what I told you was right, we should have, again, versus time delay, two exponential, and with some bits associated with the fact that we excite two lines. So how can we test this? We thought a lot about it, and there is always this question in experiment. You know, how are you sure that, if, for example, if you change samples, that you are measuring the same thing? So we thought about a way to control the correlation. When you put a magnetic field, everybody knows about this fact that now you have Landau level and so on. So you change the density of state. But the exciton also are changed. The exciton is squeezed in the magnetic field. So you start with excitons that are almost spherical, and you make cigar-like exciton. And when they are cigar-like, now they have a quadrupole, and therefore they can interact. So that's very interesting because you can put your sample in a cryostat, put the laser beam on the sample, touch nothing, and just change the magnetic field, and you change the correlation between the excitons. So you don't have any problem associated with, you know, different type of sample and so on. And this is an experiment done with gallium arsenide, simple, you know, 1 micron gallium arsenide, and exactly what I described. No magnetic field, about 10 tesla. You see, at low magnetic field, it's about the curve that I showed you before. Beats superimpose on two exponential, and the mean field approximation seems to work quite well. But then those excitons are almost spherical. If you increase the magnetic field, you see that the negative time delay, remember this is the correlation-related signal, become bigger and bigger, and obviously is no more exponential at all. In fact, the curvature is very strange because it is like this. And then at very high magnetic field, you start to see that even on the side where the atomic-like response has to is non-zero, you start to see that there is something going on. If you measure for different conditions the spectrum, so for example, this is as a function of delta T at 6 tesla, you see that there is really quantum beats between those two lines. The one is going up, the other is going down. Or if you fix the time delay and you change the magnetic field, the 0 tesla, 6, and 10, you see that there is beats between the different different lines. So obviously, we are changing the correlation by changing the shape of those excitons.
I would like to understand which regime we are. So presumably, you are the frequency of the light is a little bit below the gap, right?
No. Where I just showed before. Just exciting those two excitons. This is the laser.
So it's below the semiconducting gap, but you tune to the frequency of
exactly,
the exciton.
Of the exciton.
And then you create lots of excitons.
I'm going to come back and give you exact number because that's one important point. But typically, we try to make sure that there is several Bohr radius, exciton Bohr radius between the exciton. But I'll come back on this. This is a very important point.
Okay.
I'll give the number exactly. Okay, so that means that, you know, this RPA approach is not right, and people have developed the dynamically controlled truncation theory or theme, which give a consistent way to account for 2-point, 4-point, 6-point correlation function. It turns out that Shaul Mukamel was the first one to talk about this, but Shaul is a chemist, and I don't know, we never pay attention to what the chemists do, and so he's almost never referenced in the literature. The people that have really developed this technique are Martin Axe and Arne Stahl in Germany, and Wilfried Schaeffer has also pushed the technique to quite a very sophisticated type of result. Of course, you understand that as you start to account for more and more correlation, the computation become more and more complicated. Anyway, that's a result that Wilfried has calculated for us, reproducing the experiment. One thing that the theorists can do and we cannot do in the experiment, you can, in the computer, turn off Coulomb interaction. So if you turn off the 4-point correlation function, you get the blue curve. If you let it in, you get the red curve. So you see the very large increase for negative time delay that we have seen. What was a surprise for me and for many experimentalists was, even in the regime where the atomic-like theory is supposed to work, the increase is of a factor of 10. So in fact, the correlation is responsible for most of the signal, positive or negative time delay. And Wilfried is able to reproduce those bits and so on. So what is the origin of this? Again, I use my trick to collapse the equation in one or two. So this is what I've shown before. But now if you want to account for 4-point correlation, you need to see if there is a two-photon transition. Okay. And the equation looks like this. I call it B for bi-exciton. It is driven by two polarization, and then you can also go from here to here by making one step up and a double step down. Okay. So now this is the new average polarization model for the case where the correlation is important, and you see that this was the atomic response. This was the RPA response, and now this is the 4-particle correlation function response. And you can see immediately why it is non-Markovian. Because you can integrate this equation and then take the result and put it here. And then you have an equation only for the polarization, but it depends on the polarization before. Okay. So all the approximation when people speak about a T2 and, you know, line width and so on, if you do experiments that are really resolved in time, you see more than this. So to answer to Gabby's response, what is the origin of all this mess? Okay. So we start with an excitation of about 10 to the 7, which means that there is 25 nanometer between each exciton. And this is about 2 Bohr radius. And that's 2 Bohr radius, you know, RPA is quite good. And now you start to reduce the density. And then you get a point where there is like 100 Bohr radius between them. And then this negative time delay becomes absolutely dominant. In passing, it's the reverse of what people expect, because nonlinearity usually is when you increase intensity. Here is when you decrease intensity, you get more and more nonlinear signal. And it's simply that the mean field is no more valid. If you have very few scattering events, there is large fluctuation of the order parameter, and mean field theory breaks down.
Also, if the intensity would be larger and the excitons being to
at some point, you have a more transition. Or? That's another story. Okay, so you are nonlinear on both sides. I agree.
But like what? Can you continue?
You expect the
more transition.
Again, it gets also, again, strongly correlated.
But different type of correlation. Okay.
When you are at low density, do you see any localization effects
on art sample, no. if the sample are really...
This
is gallium arsenide. Okay. If you have poor quality sample, then yes, you have localization at very, very low density. Then you have some kind of islands where you know, the energy is slightly lower and you start to populate those. Think for the theories, we have published a couple of papers in obscure journal, like for Physical Review Letter, hoping to attract some attention. Because, for example, you can study now the coherence of the four-port correlation function by phonons. Okay, and look and see that the four-port correlation function has a temperature dependence much sharper than the so-called T2. Or you can study this correlation function depending of if you create carrier, two type of exciton, or only one type of exciton. And as a function of the type of carrier that you're creating, of a density, you can have an idea about how the four-point correlation function varies or not. I was hoping that somebody will try to model this. We don't know why, and we have no explanation. And by the way, at those densities, the number of phonons is so small that it showed an extreme sensitivity of the four-point correlation function to phonons. I don't have time to do. Okay, why do we know to go beyond the chi-3 level or the third order susceptibility? So first I go back to a very old experiment. This is the last experiment I did in France before leaving. This was for the thesis of Alain Marouani. And the detector is extremely sophisticated. So we put the two beam in a piece of copper chloride, and you put a piece of paper and you use a Polaroid camera and you take a picture. And you see 4 photon, 6 photon, 8 photon, 12, 10 photon, and 12 photon processes. Okay. And this is because in copper chloride, the transition between the exciton and the bi-exciton is extremely large, about 10 to the 3 times larger than the transition between the ground state and the exciton, and which is already very large. So you can imagine to go up, make a certain number of round trips like this, and go down. And if you sum this, you get a self energy that is field dependent. So at very low density, you can have really something that is not described by perturbation theory. So this is the only sample that has not been grown at Santa Barbara. This is coming from Wolfsburg. It's a zinc selenide sample. And we looked at the next order, six-wave mixing. And it's, again, it's very simple. Rather than showing you those kind of curve, which you see the time delay between pulse and the energy, because 3D hides something, I will show you the contour maps. Okay, and so this is an experiment where you still put two of those beams. You control the polarization, so you have polarization sigma plus on one and sigma plus on the other one, and you detect in a slightly different direction. So it's the same experiment as before. You only push your detector slightly off by a small angle. Now, if the theory at the level of e to the 5 was right, those two curves should be the same, because x is 1 over square root of 2 sigma plus sigma minus. Since I'm putting a detector to only select sigma plus, I will extract only the sigma plus, and therefore the two curves should be exactly the same. This one should be just a bit smaller by a factor of 2, something like this. And obviously they are not. Okay. So it means that there is many other processes, I don't know what, that are involved in this experiment. Now, what was a shock, and I have to say, even for me, was this is a single quantum well, only 10 nanometer thick sample. Okay, and there is about 100 Bohr radius between each exciton. So the density is extremely, extremely, extremely small. And yet, you cannot apply perturbation theory. So
why is the oscillator strength so large, the exciton to bi-exciton?
So So
why is you mentioned that?
Oh, the exciton to bi-exciton. It's because the bi-exciton Bohr radius is even bigger. The distance is even bigger. So this is related to what is called the Rajbah giant oscillator strength. If you go to the paper by Emmanuel Rajbah in 1975, he explains this to explain why excitons bound on an impurity have a very large oscillator. And essentially, it's almost like a classical model. Suppose that you have an impurity, but then it could be an exciton. The other exciton make a very big orbit and act like an antenna. So the second exciton has much more interaction with the field than the first one. Okay. You can put this in equation and so on. So I'm going to show some calculation done by Martin Axe. Each one of those curves, I believe Martin has, I don't know, 10 hours on the cray. So this is what's happened if you only account for 2 and 4 point correlation functions, and obviously doesn't look at all like the experiment. This is when you add incoherent density, so assume that some of the carrier that you are creating lose their phase and therefore can act as a passive audience of the process. So you start to see a little bit of signal here, and this is no more smooth. And the last one is when he put also this kind of 6-point correlation function, which in atomic physics will be called an excited state transition. And Martin stopped here because the people in the computer center just kick him out. So this is not yet good enough. But at least it starts to have, you know, many of the features that you are expecting. One thing that the theories can do and we cannot do is turn off and on certain things. So I ask him, you know, what is due to the exciton and the bi-exciton, and what is due to the continuum state. So this is if you keep only the bound states, the bound exciton and the bound bi-exciton. This is you keep only the continuum. And you see both of them are bits, but they are out of phase. And if you add them, then the bits disappear and you have this smooth response. So all my cartoon that I put like this, and all the cartoon that you see where people represent exciton, bi-exciton, and so on, like atomic line, are completely misleading. You need to account for all the states of bound correlated particles, even if they are almost free, because they are not really almost free, they feel each other. Okay, let's move on to this. Let me finish with something. So there's several motivation behind this. If you look at the semiconductor, the ground state, which is, you know, all the valence band occupied, all the conduction band empty, itself is very correlated. When people in the old days, I mean old days, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago, were calculated pseudo-potential calculation, the germanium was always coming out of the calculation as a semi-metal. And then Steve Louis and Marvin Cohen put the correlation in the ground state and found that you could correct this. But if you look at the plasma associated with the full valence band, so 4 electrons per atom in gallium arsenide, you find that the energy is about 10 EV, which means that the response time of those plasmons is almost instantaneous. I say almost because we are now starting to be not too far from this. Martin Wegener and in Germany and Toshio Kobayashi in Japan start to have lasers that are 3 to 4 femtoseconds. So pretty soon we will be able to look at this. And having a correlated ground state is something difficult. Unless you remember of the work of Stormer and Sui and so on and von Kirchen, and we see that the two-dimensional electron gas in the magnetic field is strongly correlated. And then we look at this and you say, oh, gee, there is many other things. There is a bunch of new excitation. When you are close to a full lambda level, it behaves like a incompressible fluid. And then there is phase coherence because you can measure those things. So it's interesting to look at those systems. So I'm going to show two types of experiments. One, we on purpose lengthen the pulse so it is short in the frequency domain and we can excite only one lambda level. Or on the contrary, we take, so this is about 400 to 500 femtosecond. And this is when we are between 80 and 100 femtoseconds, so the pulse is broad in frequency, and we can excite two lambda level, and then we can move them and play some games also with what is excited, what is not excited. This is the photograph showing you the evolution of the absorption versus magnetic field. So at the beginning, you see a Fermi-Hesse singularity, and then the light hole. This already showed the quality of the sample, and then the Landau fan start to appear, and around, let's say, 5.5 or 6 Tesla, we are in the fractional occupation regime where only the lowest Landau level is occupied. If you look at the different polarization, as soon as you put a magnetic field, the valence band start to be mixed together. There is a good paper by Broido and Sham on this. So we use always sigma plus to simplify our life because the spectrum is much simpler. But in fact, we should put a student and ask him to also look at the sigma minus case. Let's look at first the experiment where we excite the lowest lambda level. So we change the magnetic field and we always adjust the laser so we are in coincidence with the lowest lambda level and try to avoid exciting higher levels. And we see some very interesting things. So at high magnetic field, obviously it's not exponential. And then it starts to become more and more exponential. And when we are very close to the full filling factor, it really becomes exponential with an extremely long, long relaxation time. And then when the lambda level, the Fermi energy jump to the next lambda level, very suddenly you see the relaxation time become extremely fast. In fact, if you plot the relaxation time, there's those big spike. I don't know if this point is right because as you get closer and closer to the full lambda level, the signal becomes smaller and smaller. And these become longer and longer and become more and more difficult to measure. So it could be much higher. And those are two different samples grown with 2.6 and 5, 10 to the 11. And you see that those jumps occur exactly when you have full Landau levels. So this is in the time domain. If you do experiment in the frequency domain, you see that you have beautiful Lorentzian shape when you are close to the exactly full lambda level. This is fixing the time delay but changing the magnetic field, and this is fixing the magnetic field and changing the time delay. And you see that the line shape become non-Lorentzian. And this is completely consistent with the time domain. Let me go back on this a little bit. If I have a relaxation time that is given by a Meyer-Mueller kernel, you see this is a convolution. So if I Fourier transform, I get a scattering rate that is frequency dependent. So every time you see a line shape that is not Lorentzian, it means there is some memory somewhere. So where this comes from? So nature is very tricky. There is always ways to excite wave in nature. And the magnetorotoron are a very good candidate for this. Interestingly, the magnetorotoron, you see, it's just the phase of the cyclotron orbit. So although the density is unchanged and the lambda level is almost completely full, so you cannot put anything else there, there is still a way to destroy the coherence by adjusting the phase of the cyclotron orbit. At least that's a picture of an experimentalist, okay? Then you can make some simple calculation and you find that there is a term that is showing the occupation, and you can get the red curve. Again, because I don't know exactly the height of this point, I could get a better fit by shifting this. But obviously, there is a discrepancy between the curve above. And if you put some numbers, it is consistent with the magnetoroton behaving as a reservoir and keeping some memory stored in the magnetoroton. Theory is not able to describe this. We don't know how to reconcile the experiment with the theory. Let me go quickly to the next case where I'm going to show experiments that are exciting different. And if people are interested, this is just appear in PRL just a few weeks ago. So first, no theory. Art and his group made two samples. One is modulation dope, and the other is not modulation dope. And they control the growth in such a way that the exciton parameters are almost exactly the same. Okay, so if the 2D electron gas didn't have any effect, those two signals should be exactly the same, and obviously they are not. The undoped sample behave a little bit what you would expect. You excite, on the back you see the absorption of the sample, and you see the laser in blue. So you see, even in the linear spectrum, you see that the lambda level number one has a different line shape than, so there is an effect of the 2D electron gas even on the lambda level number one. But if you look at this, you see some nice bits and a response that is roughly in proportion of the number of carriers that you are creating in the two lambda levels. I will show some things to show that it's a bit more complicated than just atomic physics, but it is what your intuition will tell you. Here it's completely strange because you see you excite as mesh on both sides and there is almost nothing here. But you see beats, and beating with nothing else is very difficult. Okay, you can, you know, if you hear two flutists playing, you need the two flutes to hear the beats. If one flutist is playing alone and there is beats, it has to come from something else, okay? This is what you should expect from a few level system. So this is just a calculation if you assume atomic like response, and you will have only beats in proportion again with the excitation and nothing for negative time delay. So this is a more careful measurement of the undoped sample, exciting only the second Landau level, then there is almost no response at the first Landau level, exciting both and you have response, and there is some remains of the many-body interaction, so you need to go to the RPA level to try to explain the undoped sample. The doped sample is completely crazy. If you excite mostly the second lambda level, you get signal for both. So the red is the doped sample and the blue is the undoped sample. I told you that the RPA will predict that this goes about twice this side. So the lambda level number one response is pretty good agreement with the RPA, but the lambda level zero is not at all in agreement with the RPA. Okay. And we measure many things. For example, the bits are always related to the distance between the lambda level one and two. The signal again, unusual signal on the lambda level zero is only seen at very low excitation density. So again, telling you that the mean field theory do not apply, but you need to have a little bit of excitation. And then I'll come back at the end. If you excite more, you see a very strong dip at the center that always stay at the center of the curve. So go back to work of Kalin and Alperin and Alan MacDonald and Steve Gervin and Phil Platzman and so on. and look at the excitation that you can have between lambda level 0 and 1. If you are almost completely full, you have something that looks like an exciton. If the lambda level 0 is in the fractional occupation, there is some reaction of the gas. So, you know, as an experimentalist, I put some wiggle on it, so you get what people call the inter-lambda level magnetoplasma. And there is transition that we cannot see in the undoped sample. So you can create an exciton, then because of the resonance, this electron can go down as you create a magnetoplasma, and then this can give you emission on the other level. Okay. If there is a magneto, if you go to this transition, you can also destroy it and get emission from the other side. So clearly, the magnetoplasma gives you a way to couple the two lambda levels, and it is a resonant process. So you need to include this at all levels, not stop in perturbation theory at the first time. One thing that is important is that this introduces a new state with four particles. And you see this exciton is destroyed as you create a magnetoplasma. The lambda level in the valence band are mixed. And now here you have four particles. So you need at least to go to the four-point correlation function if you want to describe those guys. So the theory was developed by Ilias Pirakis and his student. And again, it is only a theory to the third order. So you have you go from the ground state to state where there is one photo electron hole pair. Then you can go down, but I put this different from this one because there could be some magnetoplasmon here. Or you can have two electron hole pairs. And go a bit quickly on this to show, for example, one process that is important in forward mixing, but you cannot see in undoped sample. So you can have this excitation. Remember, in forward mixing, because the process is coherent, at the end you should go back to a sample in the ground state. So you can have one photon, create a magnetoplasmon, then the magnetoplasmon propagates in time, then there is emission for the second photon, absorption of third photon, destruction of the magnetoplasmon, and the last process. So you are back to the ground state, and during some time there is energy and phase stored in the two-dimensional gas with some phase. Okay. And for example, if you can, so the way we have done the experiment, we have fitted the linear absorption to the model of Ilias to have the minimum number of parameter. And this is what the theory gives, and that's what the experiment gives, so it's not bad. Again, at low excitation density. In theory, they can do many things. For example, they can change the position very easily and see how you start with two signals that are almost the same order of magnitude to get to one where only one of them is response. But at the level where they are doing their experiment, you see the line shape is very smooth on both of them. And let me go quickly some intermediate results just to show one thing. If we increase a little bit the density, we have this dip at the center that develops as you increase the density. And I have no proof of this, but my intuition tells me that this is the response time of the magnetoplasmon. Magnetoplasmon should take a certain time to respond. And even if you create many of them, the response is not instantaneous. So this is, of course, not included in the theory, but we want to go on and measure more to try to understand what is the origin of this. So again, perturbation theory does not apply. Okay, so conclusion. The correlation effect governs all the nonlinear optical response of materials weakly or strongly correlated. Okay, no doubt of it. If you do coherent nonlinear spectroscopy, then you access stuff like memory structure and decoherence. And this is very important, not only for basic physics like what I'm doing, but there is many discussion about quantum processing of information and so on, maintaining coherence over a long time to make computation and so on. As long as we don't understand this, those applications will never see see any result. What we have with semiconductor is extremely good sample. In fact, sample that I can design. I mean, Art has left, but frankly, it's without him we cannot do any of those things. Because I go to him and tell him I want a sample that can do this, and he's able to design the sample exactly the way I want it, and wonderful. I think that the same kind of thing can be done on strongly correlated system. I didn't discuss this because Steve Dodge was here last week, and Steve, I believe, started to talk about this. When was it?
A few weeks ago.
Anyway, so we have in our in my lab some at least a group that called a postdoc and a student who are starting to look at cuprate and manganate and so on. Why I've not put too much emphasis on this is that it's extremely difficult to know if what you measure is real or it's due to the fact that the samples are just bad. Okay. When we ask some of the best crystal growers, I don't want to give the impression that those people are not doing their job well. They don't know, how many impurity, they don't know the doping exactly, they don't. So we see things, maybe we'll publish some stuff, but I don't know if I will at this point, I don't know if what we measure are really intrinsic or not. But definitely, two-photon process and three-photon process and so on should give a lot of information on correlation, even in those materials. And I'll stop here. I talked already for 1 hour.
Can I ask a question about the magnetic field effect on the exciton? Which you mentioned in the first part. If I do the time-dependent Hartree Fock, which you described, which I would call RPA, you have two type of many-body effects. One is the excitonic binding energy, and the second one is the dipole interaction between the excitons, and this gives rise to motion of the excitons. So my question is, can you directly measure not only the shape of the excitons, which would be changed if I include a magnetic field, but also the motion of the excitons?
Okay,
because
so
that's also changed by including.
You're perfectly right. So in the experiment I've shown, we measure almost essentially what is going on at k equals zero.
Yeah, right.
So we measure the shape of the exciton, and we can relate this in the low density regime to the quadrupole interaction. And if you put numbers, it fits, correctly. Now, the question is, how do we access excitons that have a large center of mass momentum? It's possible to do it, but the experiments are much more complicated because you need to change the angle in such a way that you promote the grating in the sample at large k. It's possible. I've not presented anything like this, but it is possible to make the two.
Because that will give you additional information on these many volumes.
Absolutely. Attack.
In this last set of data, you showed that the dephasing time becomes very long for nu equals 2. Why don't you see anything at nu equals 1?
Oh, no. I used the nomenclature of quantum Hall effect. It's because the spin are not separated.
I see.
So what you and I will call nu equal 1. Okay. But one thing important. Nature is very tricky. So you see, as you decrease the magnetic field to get to the nu equal 1, the oscillator strength goes to 0. So, of course, the relaxation time becomes extremely long. But why? Because the system is isolated. If it is isolated from the reservoir, it is isolated from you and me also. So we cannot couple to it. I think this is a major problem for quantum computing. We need to find a way to switch on the interaction with the system when we write and read, and then switch off when the system evolved by itself. Otherwise, we're done. Okay, and we have some very nice thing about the exciton order states, but I don't know if some people are interested this afternoon, I can give a short talk on it.
Yeah, actually, I think if you're available, we
I'm here, so, yeah.
At some point this afternoon, and we're very interested.
See the rest of the things and have some discussion.
Okay.
Whatever you would like to good. Tell okay. us about.
You tell me when I'm here.
What about round four?
That's fine. Before was it?
Three
is fine.
3 o'clock.
Three is fine. Okay, good.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Here if it's available. Otherwise, we'll go in the conference room over there.
Okay.
Okay. So I can.
Thanks very much.